Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So the time is nigh, winter retreat. Everybody here, all Dhamma practitioners, but really all beings, everybody's on a spiritual journey. And with the Dhamma practice, it's giving clarity to what this body and mind is and what it means to be spiritual beings and how to gain insight into our body and mind and how to practice and train so that we can learn about ourselves in a very deep, complete way. Because one of the epithets for the arahant, for one who has completed the practice, completed the work, one of the epithets is they're called a no more learner. And anyone who isn't yet an arahant is termed as a learner. So there's a lot to learn about ourselves, about how to practice. And we're all on a spiritual journey. If we think in a Buddhist way, we take on the Buddhist cosmology. We may not have insight into our own past lives, and yet if we take on faith, the magnitude of samsara that we've been transmigrating, being reborn and re-dying, rebirth and re-death over and over and over again since beginningless time is samsara. And I remember somebody telling me once, like, there's this conception that some people have young souls and some people have medium souls and some people have old souls, but in these terms, everybody is very, very, very old, and how many years old we are in this lifetime doesn't really show how incredibly ancient all of us are. So samsara is very this transmigration from birth, aging, death, birth, aging, death, over and over and over again. There's the view that all of us are very, very ancient beings. And it's suffering to be born and age, get sick, get old, die, be born again and again and again, not always as a human being. Very rarely as a human being. Born as an animal, born as a ghost, born as wandering spirits, born as celestial beings, heavenly beings, have experienced bliss and also the depths of suffering. And samsara means wandering on, so it's over and over and over. Wandering on and on in the dark in samsara. There's a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya where it's interesting because a bhikkhu asks the Buddha a question, what is something? There's all these different suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya where a bhikkhu might ask, you know, metta, metta, what is metta? Or nibbana, nibbana, what is nibbana? And so bhikkhu asks, samsara, samsara, what is samsara? What is meant by samsara? And instead of answering with a noun, All the Buddha says is, samsara is long. Samsara is long. Just the amount of tears you've shed in your past lives wandering on in samsara would fill more than all of the oceans on the earth. The amount of tears you've shed in the past from suffering, torment, discontent would fill even more than the great oceans, than all of the oceans in the world. And think of how deep the oceans are, how big the oceans are. All of the bones that you've left behind would be more than the entire earth. Just think of the size of the earth, the weight of the earth, from the center all the way out. And if that was completely made of bones, and we've left, even each individual has left behind even more bones than that. So we might be excited or ecstatic if we have insight into one or two of our past lives. But this is more than one or two past lives. This is trillions, gazillions, uncountable past lives. And the Buddha, on the night of his enlightenment, with the detailed insight, and the precise clarity, and the intense focus of his insight into past lives, he remembered uncountable past lives, one life, two life, 10 lives, 1,000 lives, 100,000 lives, lives back through one world expansion and contraction of the entire universe, 10 expansions and contractions of the universe, 100,000 expansions and contractions of the universe, remembering in each life I was such and such a being, was designated as such and such, or if as a human being was part of such and such a clan, had such and such a name, having been born there, I passed away and re-arose there. And so this is a spiritual journey. There's much more than what we can perceive with our current state of mind. And then the practice leads us into a world which is much bigger than the world that we know. So being open-minded, they say we have to come into the practice with an empty cup. So we empty out our knowledge, empty out who we think we are, and allow the cup to be empty, so we can take in the contents of the Buddha's teaching and of the Dhamma practice, and so we can learn. And then that's good to come in with an empty cup, and then the real skill is to keep emptying it over and over, keep emptying it, so that the knowledge can become more precise, and we can fill it with more and more pure knowledge, more and more pure water. So we keep emptying the cup over and over. And then the insight of anatta and the insight into satipatthana is the great emptiness. And so it's emptying the cup over and over to the point where there's a realization into that emptiness. That's called sunyata. Sunyata, and then tatata. Tatata is thusness. So, why do beings transmigrate, being born, getting old, dying over and over and over again? The Buddha said it's because of being hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Hindered by ignorance, fettered by craving. And these are the true mother and father of beings. but we can't really see these things, and most of us, so we take it on faith. And then we live our lives in the best way possible, the most wholesome way possible. And our life, even this, just this life, as the days go by, passing, the weeks, months, years go by, and it can seem quite long, quite a long time. So we don't even need to think of the endlessness of samsara. Even just this one life can seem quite long. I've had many experiences. But if we think of impermanence and uncertainty and anicchang, we think back maybe 10 years ago. So the experience seemed long at the time, or maybe we experienced some sort of suffering or even periods of great happiness, but it just passes by. It just flows on and on. And at the end of this life, it'll be just like that. Our whole life will be gone. Our whole life will have passed just like a flash of light, like a flash of lightning. And once it's gone, it doesn't seem so long anymore. So the mind, training the mind. Because as the body grows older, the mind is doing something different. The mind, if it's not being trained, the mind isn't maturing, the mind isn't growing older. The body grows older following its nature. But one might think, oh, when I'm 80 years old, 90 years old, maybe I'll, then my mind will somehow be more ready for death, I'll be more prepared. But no, we have to practice, we have to prepare now. The mind's not going to be that much different. It doesn't just naturally change as we get older. It takes persistence. We have to train ourselves. It takes effort, and without the effort, the mind will stay the same age. The body will get older, and the mind will stay the same age. So it takes training, and it's possible, it's doable. Invariably, we're going to take on the meditation practice and the Dhamma practice the way we take on anything else. So it's like taking on a skill. So any skill there's going to be necessary persistence, failures, successes. One learns from one's mistakes. There might be times one is butting your head up against a wall, seems impossible. And then you persist, you keep going, you just keep investigating. Where did I go wrong? Why isn't it working? Look into it. It's like, I like to use the analogy of sharpening, like sharpening knives. So it's like when you're learning how to sharpen, you read the text, read the books, and then you try to sharpen something. You find you need to hold it in a certain way. The book can't really teach you that hands-on doing, just doing it. Doing it really is what teaches you. And so you have a coarser sharpening stone and a finer sharpening stone and then the finest sharpening stones. And you need a guide. The steel has to stay at the same angle. So you need to have a guide. It has to be at the proper angle according to the use that you want out of that steel, out of that knife. And so at first it might be, okay, well I've done exactly what the book said, but this knife isn't very sharp. And so you try again. well, let's try again. Okay, maybe the touch was wrong. Maybe the pressure was wrong. Maybe the angle was slightly off. And try again now. It's not that sharp. Maybe it's a little bit better, but it's still not sharp. It looks sharp. To the eye, it looks sharp. It looks like it's supposed to, according to the book. I did everything the book said, but it's not really sharp. So I'll try again, again, again. And then you look into it. Well, let's get out the magnifying glass and look at the edge of that knife. Where am I going wrong? Oh yeah, I wasn't really reaching the edge. So then you learn, oh, I have to set the bevel. The edge of that steel was pitted, warped, not straight. So I have to go to a coarser stone, set the bevel, because the magnifying glass reveals that, oh, what I was doing, I wasn't even reaching the true edge of that knife. There was still just dullness there. And then one finds, okay, setting the bevel is a lot of work because that steel usually isn't perfectly straight. It's been misused in the past. It's been mistreated in the past. So it takes a lot of work to get a straight, even edge all the way up and down the blade on both sides, equal on both sides. It can take hours. But you can't just press really hard. You can't just press harder and make it happen faster. That's also going to bend the blade and make it not true. It's going to make the scratches too big in it. And just even pressure over and over and over for hours. And it gets worn down and the bevel gets set. Say, okay, let's take the magnifying glass out again. Take a look. Okay, now it's even on both sides and I can see the edges are meeting each other. Then you go back to the original. You've been working on the extra coarse stone, so you go just back to the coarse stone. And now it doesn't take so much work. It's just a few minutes on the coarse stone, medium stone, fine stone, extra fine stone. Ending with the stropping, polishing. And then let's take it, let's test it. Now it cuts. Now it cuts with no effort at all. And if the knife is really sharp, you can just drop it, even just using the weight of the knife, allowing the weight of the knife to drop down on a carrot or a cucumber, and just slices right through it. You don't need to press down at all. Just the sharpness just cuts right through. So that's a lot like the practice. Meditating, practicing. We're sincere. Then hey, things aren't coming together. I read about the jhanas. Vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. We're supposed to have directed, applied thought and sustained thought. Rapture, happiness, one-pointedness. We're supposed to have all these factors. We're not supposed to have the five hindrances, which is sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt. Yet, where are those jhana factors, and why are the hindrances still so strong? Well, let's take the magnifying glass out. And, all right, well, I'm rubbing away at these two edges, but I haven't really gotten, things aren't coming to a point. Things aren't really coming together. So let's step back. Let's go to a coarser stone. How's the sila? How's the precepts? Oh, right, maybe I broke this or that precept. Or sila isn't purified. So let's go back. Let's take stock of our actions of body, speech, and our mental habits. So what's happening there? So we train ourselves. Am I perfect in my conduct, or is it patchy? Is there places where I have to raise the bar? So then, okay, going back to the conduct, to the precepts, integrity. And then the mental conduct, how am I mentally relating to others? How am I mentally relating to myself? Is it with goodwill, good wishes, loving kindness, metta, or is it with irritation, aversion? Am I practicing out of a sense of aversion to myself, out of a sense of wanting to change myself from something bad to something good, out of a sense of wanting to kill the defilements, get the defilements out, kill the hindrances, get rid of all my emotional garbage? But coming back to a sense of well-wishing for oneself. Getting back to the basics. Setting the bevel. And that takes a long time, just learning how to live in the practice, live in the form of the practice. So we have a daily schedule, we have chanting and meditation, period for time for solitude. We have chores that we do, keeping the monastery clean, looking after things. The chanting is quite important, actually. We can relate to the chanting as something meaningless and useless, or we can use it as a skillful means. So when we chant, you know, the Buddha's teachings, or we chant like qualities of the Dhamma apparent here and now, inviting one to come and see timeless, leading inwards, to be brought inwards, or chanting the qualities of Buddha, qualities of the Sangha. So chanting the qualities of the Triple Gem on a daily basis and paying respects to the Triple Gem on a daily basis, this is very, very important. And over time, it can either become something that we just become inured to and bored with, or we can become more inspired, and it can be used as a skillful means to bring our practice ever deeper so that we start to chant with a sense of gratitude and sincerity. To see these very senior monks, both Western and in Thailand, you might see very old monks, been ordained 30, 40, even 50 years. If you watch them chant and watch how they pay respects, and you just get a sense for that sincerity, it's very, very important. So the daily schedule, the chanting, the meditation using just the basic techniques, anapanasati or buddho, metta practice, asubha kamatana, just this basic practices as part of the daily schedule, chanting, meditation, chores, the meal, and bringing the sila into all of these things, with a sense of goodwill for oneself and a sense of sincerity, over and over and over again, days, weeks, months, years of that, you know, setting the bevel. So once the bevel is set, then you can move through the stones fairly quickly. sit down and meditate, it's not so difficult to think of something to be grateful for. Bring up piti, rapture. Bring up a sense of devotion, sincerity. Sukha is there, sukha, happiness. Let go of distraction, confusion, a sense of becoming into the present moment. So ekagata, one-pointedness. With those factors in place, it's quite easy to be inspired to have applied and sustained thought. And hindrances come up, but there's a sense of zeal, a sense of persistence, a sense of inspiration. The knife will get sharp, the wisdom will get sharp, but it still takes a sense of persistence. So it's moving up through the sharpening stones, medium, coarse, fine, extra fine. Then we might lose the plot temporarily. That's likened to dropping the knife. We have to go back and reset the bevel. But it's just all of our ajans, it's the teaching on it, just persistence is so important. It's like, okay, there was some hindrance that came into the mind, some sort of aversion, some sort of desire. But with that persistence, we can always come back to why we're practicing, why we're here. And then slowly the practice is also, it's a retraining of perception. So if we come in with our empty cup, ready to receive whatever we can from the Buddha's teachings, then we're ready to retrain the way our perceptions are working, the way our desire systems are working. Changing our worldly default options, default reactions to life, into spiritual default options, spiritual default reactions. So normally the worldly default reaction to anything pleasant is desire, greed. Worldly default reaction to anything unpleasant is aversion, or on a coarser level, anger, ill will. Worldly default reaction to neutral feeling, neutral sense media is delusion, or a desire for something more interesting, something more extreme, something pleasant or unpleasant, that we can be greedy or averse to, instead of just having to be bored and confused. Attraction, aversion, delusion. These are the default, worldly default options of the mind. So it's, the practice is changing those worldly default options into spiritual default options. So pleasant sense media, anything pleasant that we contact, reacting rather than with desire and greed, a sense of like a coolness or a renunciation. Unpleasant, unpleasant words or criticism or anything unpleasant, sense media, rather than reacting with irritation, aversion, then reacting with goodwill, good wishes, loving kindness. And then with neutral sense media, using wisdom and mindfulness, satipanya, to be able to be calm and at ease with that which is neutral. But really it's all craving and ignorance. It's a desire to, gather in, a desire to gather in, a desire to push away. The suttas are really interesting, even fascinating, because there's always these strings of suttas where the Buddha will say, there's one thing that if let go of will bring an end of suffering. What is that one thing? Greed. And then the next sutta will say, there's one thing that when let go of will bring an end of suffering, aversion. And then the next sutta will say, there's one thing when let go of will bring an end of suffering, delusion. And so this is fascinating, because the way the Buddha had to try and put the Dhamma into words. So under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha realized something. He realized the ending of suffering. But even that is just words. What he realized, he's saying, what did I realize? Well, it's an ending of suffering. But yet it's so much more than that. It's an ending of the round, the entire round of rebirth. And then he's trying to formulate his teaching, thinking, what is that? What was that that was obstructing the mind from full liberation and freedom? And it's kind of fun to imagine, just imagine the Buddha trying to formulate the teaching, trying to formulate the Dhamma teaching, thinking, okay, well, that's interesting. That's greed, aversion, delusion. So they're all the same thing. So you get these strings of suttas. There's just one thing when let go. So he's calling, there's an energy that he's calling it different things. It's not that we have to have these kind of lists that if we memorize, then somehow there'll be insight based on that, but it's a skillful means, and the Buddha's pointing to something which is amazing. And we seek it, as spiritual seekers. We seek that which is amazing, which is wonderful, magnificent. The end of the suttas, you get this. It's wonderful, it's magnificent. The Buddha guiding people to insight. It can be difficult if we, Buddhism has been established in Thailand, and then if we even look at the history of Buddhism, Tibet, China, say taking Thailand as an example, well established, the language is formulated around the Buddha's teachings. And the Dhamma, it's a paradigm of the Dhamma. The Thai language is formed around Dhamma words, Dhamma phrases, just deep cultural understandings of certain aspects of Dhamma, such as dana. And so there's difficulty in translating that, but I think it's helpful to imagine what's going through the Buddha's mind on the night of his awakening, and when he's trying to formulate how that awakening happened and how to express the teaching. Because there's so many ways to express it. The Buddha said that if he could, just taking the Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha said that if he spoke continuously about the Satipatthana, only stopping to sleep and to eat and to use the loo, and if he talked like that for 100 years and without repeating himself, that still he would not exhaust all of the things that could be said and all the ways the Satipatthana could be expressed. So there's the awakening of the Buddha, which is what we ourselves are seeking, hopefully. And there's also how that happened, which is, that's another unbelievable aspect of the Buddha's teaching, is that there's this path to get there. And so you have it with so many, both modern and in the past, spiritual teachers, where they have they've had some sort of awakening, but nobody else can get there. None of their disciples can get there. It's just, the best you can hope for is devotion towards the teacher, devotion towards the guru. The Buddha is very radical in saying, no, it's come and see for yourself. Don't just worship the Buddha, even though the Buddha is truly worthy of worship, worthy of respect. But don't just worship the Buddha, just come and see, do the practice. And don't stop halfway, don't stop early on, keep going. If you give gifts, that's good. You have dana parami, that's good. Keep going. Practice. If you have sila, that's good, but keep going. Don't just rest content with that. Keep going. If you've managed to properly set the bevel on your knife, that's good, but don't just rest with that. Keep going. Make it sharp. Work up through the stones, work up through the stages. If you've attained deep states of peace, states of samadhi, that's good, but keep going. Don't just rest content with that. Don't stop. And we have the tools we need. What are the tools we need? The Buddha didn't need a huge set of scientific instruments to discover liberation. He didn't need anything other than his own body and mind, his own internal qualities of faith, persistence, mindfulness, mental unity, concentration, and wisdom. He didn't need anything other than his own barami. Just the simplest of cloth, robes to clothe the body, just enough food to get by, to keep practicing. The Buddha didn't need anything other than the body and mind. He didn't need any books. He didn't need any external tools. Just the body and mind and mindfulness, wisdom, a strong desire for liberation, strong desire for an ending of suffering. The Buddha was practicing out of compassion for others too. When the prince left the palace, he had just had a child. He left behind a newborn son and his wife. He left in the night when they were sleeping. And this can seem really terrible. But it's said that the reflections going through the prince's mind at the time were, I could stay with my wife and child out of compassion for these two people, and I leave the palace out of compassion for the multitude, out of compassion for the world. A sense of nibbida. Do we really have to be born and suffer over and over again? If there's a way out, I'll discover it. If there's not a way out, then I'll die trying to discover it. And this intense compassion that the prince was experiencing, was quite a young age. I mean, he was, they say, he was in his 29th year, which I think means he was actually 28. It's quite a mature mental state for that age, I think. And left the palace out of compassion for the world, out of compassion for us. We're directly contacting the efforts of that one being. Amazing. So it behooves us to rouse our persistence and walk this spiritual path in a good way, in a wholesome way. Do what we can to bring the Dhamma inwards, bring the teaching inwards. Opanaiko is leading inwards, to be brought inwards. Especially during the winter retreat, we can look outwards a little bit, but mostly looking inwards, looking at ourselves, investigating ourselves, getting to know ourselves, shifting the perceptions from the worldly to the spiritual, seeing the results of that, seeing the contentment and well-being that that brings here and now. But don't stop, don't rest content with that. Also having a sense of skillful discontent to keep learning, keep moving forward, reach the unreached, realize that which has not yet been realized. If we mess up, we lose the plot, we fall over, it doesn't matter. Go back to square one, keep going. So, probably said enough this evening. Whatever is useful, please take it with you. Whatever is not useful, please set it aside. And I'll leave it there this evening. Annamayam namakataya sadukaram dadamasehi. Sadhu.